Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Writer's Block with me, Morgan O'Reilly, right here on 90.3 Near FM. Coming up in the next hour, we've got all the best usual mix of music, interviews, and of course all things literary, so stick around. When in this charming car, this charming man, why can't the life's complexity when the leather runs smooth on the passenger seat? Yes, indeed. Why pamper life's complexities when the leather runs smooth on the passenger seat? Why indeed, Morrissey? Why indeed? Well, you're very welcome to Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. We've got another great show coming up for you today, folks. We have Mary Sheil in for the first half an hour before 4 o'clock. She's going to be talking to us about her literary career to date and some of the charities that she's been writing in aid of. After 4 o'clock, in our usual visiting writer slot, we've got Paul Murray, Dublin poet, coming in to chat to us about his poetry. And we have a couple of announcements here, a couple of congratulations. Madeline Grace, a alumni of Writer's Block, I think we had her in a month ago. She has just recently won the Crosspens Writing.ie Make Your Mark Short Story Award. She was published in the Irish Times, would you believe it, for her short story, The Girl Who Could Catch Rain. So big congratulations to Madeline, and we were delighted to have her on Writer's Block. And also another Writer's Block graduate, the very first Writer's Block graduate indeed, Philip St. John. His play, Temptress, and I can actually remember reading this play around this time last year. The play Temptress, anyway, it's opening in the new theatre in Temple Bar. That's at the Dublin Castle end of Temple Bar. It's opening on the 26th of this month and it's running until the 7th of November. Tickets are £15 and the show is going to start at 7:30 every night. So check that one out, folks. Philip St. John, he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. Again, delighted to have him here on Writer's Block. But we'll take a bit of music now. We'll get the head out as opposed to getting the let out. This is Radiohead, and stick around afterwards. We've got Mary Sheil in the studio chatting to us. And you're very welcome back to Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. Radiohead there from their album OK Computer, that was Let Down. But in studio now, we're very glad to have Mary Sheil in with us. Mary, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Morgan.
How are you? How are you getting on?
I'm getting on fine. I've got a bit of a cold, so if I'm a bit wheezy, just excuse me.
We'll try and go easy on you. So,
okay. Yeah.
So anyway, Mary, tell us a bit about yourself. You're a Dub, are you?
I'm an absolute Dub. I'm from Marino Parish, actually, which is not just down the road from here. I've lived there since I was 9. And when I got married, I just stayed in the same parish and moved from one house to another. So I've been part of Marino for a long time. And I have to say, it's an absolutely smashing place to live.
Lovely stuff.
I wouldn't go anywhere else.
It's always nice to have a good Northside Dove in.
Oh, absolutely.
So Mary, anyway, you're in to talk to us about your first book. Your latest book.
Oh, yes. The first book goes back quite a long time. Well, actually, it's two little books, and they're two books of children's stories, two complete stories in each book. And the aim is to make as much money as possible for Laura Lynn, which is the only children's hospice in the whole of Ireland, an absolutely super place. So I'm hoping that the books will sell well. Christmas is coming, so they make like nice little presents for children.
Of course, it is a wonderful, wonderful cause, the Laura Lynn Hospice.
Absolutely, yes. I had my first visit out there when I was talking to them about this, and I was so impressed by the whole setup. It's absolutely wonderful, and they depend totally on subscriptions and donations and fundraising. They don't have any government funding so far, so they really do need the money.
How do you choose what organisation to support? I mean, because there is so many worthy organisations.
I know. The choice is bewildering. But how I settled on them in the end was I was hoping to do something for children, and but you also need somewhere that they can help to sell the books, because that's very important. You can't do it all on your own. So when I heard that Laura Lynn, apart from being a wonderful place, also had an online shop, I thought, if they could cooperate and help sell the books, well, that would be a partnership, more or less. So when I went to see them, they were more than willing and have been very helpful and very enthusiastic. So we're hoping that between us we'll manage to sell a good number of books.
Lovely stuff. Well, the books are Piper's Pet Shop, book one and book two. But of course, as we were saying, this isn't your first book. You're quite a seasoned author, I suppose. You've had a number of books really published.
If I go back a long, long time, and I can go back a long, long time because I'm actually a grandmother now, but my very first children's books were published about 20 years ago. But that was just it wasn't a charity thing. I hadn't even thought about anything like that. I was absolutely thrilled to bits to have one little book accepted by Poolbeg Press. And that was really on the recommendation of a wonderful lady called Eilish Dillon. She's dead now, Lord rest her, but she wrote for adults and children. And I was at a writing course for children that she was running. And she recommended me to Poolbeg Press, a totally unknown writer, and they accepted my first little book, which was based in a crazy zoo. And it went quite well, and they took my second one, and I thought, great, I'll have my trilogy because I had enough for another book. But unfortunately it stopped there because the second book didn't sell as well as the first one, so the third one didn't actually ever make it into print, and that kind of put me off for a little bit. But it was a long time afterwards, about 8 years ago, listening to the radio, I heard two young mothers talking about their children who were patients in Crumlin Children's Hospital, talking about trying to put a book or something together of their own experiences as parents of sick children and anything else they felt like writing about, and bringing out a book, a fundraiser for Crumlin. And I thought, you know what, I've got children's books, stories tucked away in a drawer. Could I do something for some charity? And so I thought about my locality, and St. Francis Hospice in Raheny came to mind, because sadly I'd had a few friends who had to avail of their services, and I myself had had cancer. So I thought, you know, it would be wonderful to do it for them. So they were quite happy with the idea, and again were able to help selling the books because they have a sales area in their reception, and
wonderful.
You know, they do that kind of thing.
Can I ask you, you mentioned that your books originally published back in the 90s about the zoo.
Yeah.
And then your most recent books, The Piper's Pet Shop for the Laura Lynn Foundation, and then the books 8 years ago, which is, I have them here in front of me, Petal and Friends.
Yes.
And, excuse me, the other one, Humphrey and Friends, they were for the St. Francis Hospice in Raheny.
Yes. Yeah.
Is it a very... What are the differences, I suppose, between publishing something yourself and then publishing something in aid?
Totally. Yeah. When I got this, I suppose a sort of a brainwave about approaching St. Francis, well, I hadn't even thought at the time what charity I might approach, but doing it for something, I had to kind of work out a plan of how I would go about it as a totally, absolutely unknown person. Mm. And there was no point in thinking of going to an established publishing company. It was a case of do it all on your own. So the first thing I had to do was find somebody to do the illustrations for me. And I was very lucky to find this lady, whom I haven't actually ever met. She was a friend of a friend of mine in England, and she did some illustrating as a hobby, and she very, very kindly did the illustrations for those books, totally free because it was for charity. Did a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that was the start of it. And then I had to more or less sell the idea. Well, not too much selling, but, you know, you have to put the idea to the charity you want to do it for. You've got to get them totally behind you and their approval and all of the rest. Then you've got to find a printer. And then if you're lucky, might find a little bit of sponsorship to help to pay for the printing costs. And you think that that's the end of it. It's not at all. You've got to get out there then and sell the books.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a lot of hard work.
There's a huge amount of kind of entrepreneurial spirit,
I actually learned a lot from that first experience. And I must say the printer whom I used, who was over on the Long Mile Road, whom I had got through my son who'd had business dealings with them, turned out to be wonderful and very helpful, because I'm sure they had to do a lot of work on the stuff that I gave them to get it into presentable form. But the end result was very, very good. And we made a lot of money between us. Well, I think anyway, a lot of money for St. Francis Hospice. And it was also very encouraging and good feedback as well.
Wonderful. And we mentioned there the amount of entrepreneurial spirit. that it takes to write a book and to get out and sell it. But also, I mean, the key thing really is you're telling a story, and you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you're a grandmother.
Yes.
How did, I mean, did you ever tell stories to your children or even your grandchildren?
Yeah,
was that a
all the time
a source of inspiration for your, some of your
all
stories?
All the time. Well, I just love anything to do with storytelling. I love books, or the printed word or the spoken word generally. My dad died when we were very young, but the books he had that were in the house at the time, we all devoured them, and so we were reading Dickens and all those classics at a very young age because there were no other books to read. But it encouraged us, I think. Every one of my my siblings reads a lot, and I have one brother who's quite gifted with his pen as well. So it was something I think we inherited from our dad. But then I went on, and our own four children, they always got books for Christmas. We always had bedtime stories. Books were very, very much a feature of life in our house. And now it's continued on with our grandchildren. And luckily, there are a couple of them that are crazy about books. You can't keep them. You just can't give them enough books, or they're always looking for books. So it's wonderful because you get feedback from them, and you feel their enthusiasm as well as, you know.
Yeah.
So that keeps you going. And
great. And yet, and yet it took you... You mentioned Eilish Dillon, who you did your course with in the Irish Writers' Centre. And the Irish Writers' Centre have actually been wonderful supporters of this show. And you did a children's writing course, was it? Early 90s, am I right?
Oh, gosh, my goodness, back in old God's time. it seems like the last century. But yes, that was actually what sparked off my interest. And then, you know, I write adult short stories as well, and I've had a couple of things articles accepted for Sunday Miscellany, which I can tell you is pretty hard to get anything accepted by them.
Fantastic.
Because they
yeah.
get so many submissions, and a few short stories published in
Is it difficult, can I ask you, is it difficult to separate the side of you that wants to write something for adults and the side of you that wants to write something for children? Are they two separate entities?
They are, in a way, because, you know, writing for children is completely different. You've got to keep your language, while not, you know, writing sloppily or anything, you've got to keep your language fairly straightforward and simple. Mm-hmm. And I think writing for children, you need plenty of action. Kids love mayhem all over the place.
Yeah.
And the more action there is, I think, the happier they are. You know, listen to the stories. They can picture what's going on and all the fights and fights, but, you know, the things that happen. So
people,
I think writing for children is very different.
People often do say that children can be the harshest critics. You know, if something is boring to a child, they'll put it down straight away. They won't persevere.
Yeah. Yes, they will indeed. I mean, if it doesn't grab their interest really in the first page, there's a chance that they won't finish it. So, you
Lovely.
Know, you've got to really grab them when you start off. The first paragraph even.
Well, my guest today is Mary Scheel. I'm talking to her about her literary career so far. Of course, her most recent books, Piper's Pet Shop, books 1 and 2, just written and published a couple of months ago, and they're in aid of the Laura Lynn Foundation, Ireland's only children hospice. We're going to take a bit of music now, but stick around after the break. Mary will still be talking to us. She'll still be here in studio. And this song is off the 2003 album, You Are the Quarry. It's Morrissey, and it is Come Back to Camden.
There is something I wanted to tell you. It's so funny, you'll kill yourself laughing.
And that was Morrissey there off his album You Are the Quarry. We'll come back to Camden. Well, you're very welcome back to Writer's Block on 90.3 near FM, excuse me. This is Morgan O'Reilly, and my guest in studio today is Mary Scheel. Mary, just before we left you there, we were talking about your career as a writer, but you do a lot of stuff in all kinds of every manner of literacy, really. And we were chatting just before air a little bit about some of the work that you do going into schools, specifically inner city schools.
Yes, I don't really call it work because I enjoy it so much, but I heard to a friend of mine, a neighbour, that there's a small group of volunteers, they call themselves Share, and they were going into inner city schools, helping would be first and second class children, say, you know, 7 to 8 years of age, with their reading, because it's a very important age, apparently. if you don't, indeed, if you fall behind at that age, then it's difficult to catch up. So I joined this little group, and I've had the best of fun, really, going into one inner city school for the last 2 years and helping the children. They come in for about the length of a class, and there are special books which are designed to help them at their different levels they're at, and we read together, and we talk about things, and sometimes we play a little game, all of which are geared to helping them with their literacy. And it's really very most rewarding, I think. The children seem to benefit from it, but apart from that, I love it so much. I love the children and the feedback and the things they will tell you sometimes, or the remarks. They don't pull their punches. They'll tell you, they'll look at you, and sometimes they'll say things to you, you know, about yourself. Not that they don't mean to be, you know, but it certainly keeps your feet on the ground. Yeah. And it's good fun. I love it. And
and then, how many, the organisation is Share, is it?
Share, yes.
And how many hours a week does that involve?
For me, it's just one morning a week. I mean, some of the volunteers will actually go to two different schools, but I can't spare that amount of time, so I just go once a week. And I'd have two children for the length of a class each, which is about 40 minutes per child, which is really, I suppose, their attention span anyway. It's long enough.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then we have to complete reports about the children after we have finished with them. And then on 2 days later, in the school I was with, the transition year students from Belvedere were coming in, and they were taking up where we had left off with our children, reading our reports and then following on. So the children actually got two classes each per week. And at the end of the school year, the school principals are always very, very positive about the benefit to the children. Mm. A lot of these children would not be of their ethnicity, wouldn't be Irish, and they do struggle a little bit.
Of course, you
can see the improvement. Class by class, you can see the improvement in their confidence as well as their ability. So it's something really well worth doing, and I'm hoping to continue with that.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you can't emphasise enough how much of a crucial part of early education that reading is. And it brings us back to your books here, Piper's Pet Shop. It really is so, so important to get kids reading as early as you can.
Yes.
And just to have a couple of books, even in the house,
you
can flip out at night, or you can flip out in a boring rainy afternoon.
I know, a lot of these children don't really have books at
home.
Because their parents might also be struggling with English. And sometimes, if we're able to, if we have enough people, we will actually help the parents, after school things for the parents to help them with their English. Now, I haven't become involved in that because I don't really have the time, but some of the other volunteers do. And then whenever there are little, you know, occasions, special occasions, like, you know, Easter or Christmas, and we give the children gifts, it's always, always a book that they can keep, which they love, because they're going home with something that they can keep. And hopefully they will read, and maybe their parents will read as well, or help them with. So generally speaking, we just hope we're doing some good.
I'm sure you are. And I mean, is it a large catchment to schools that you're working with, or just...
Well, at the moment we just have four or five inner city schools, because there aren't enough of us. We just desperately need more volunteers, people who would be interested in joining the group. And, so we could then maybe... Yeah. You have to have the right number, and you have to have a few people in reserve in case somebody is sick or away that they can fit in for them. So you can't take on a school if you're not sure that you will have enough people to cover it, because you can't let the children down.
Of course.
So it's really limited by the number of volunteers.
And do you ever get to read Piper's Pet Shop with the kids?
No. I tell you, the books are specially graded for the children, and they follow some program. I can't remember the name of it now. So it's kind of step by step, and as you decide when the children are ready to go on to the next level. Like, we decide that ourselves when we think they're ready, and then we start them on that. And it's amazing how you will see the children progress from one level to the next. But it's all very carefully structured. I think, you know, a lot of thought has gone into how it's done and how it's progressed, and hopefully, you know, it works. We wouldn't be able to decide what was different for children, because, well, I'm not a trained teacher, or most of the volunteers are not. So we do need guidance as well.
Of course, but it's still a fantastic role, fantastic thing that you're doing. But back to Back to Piper's Pet Shop. It's a really gorgeous little book that I have in front of me, and of course, well, for a fantastic cause.
I'm really delighted to have the opportunity now to thank, it's actually Morgan's brother, Adrian, who did the illustrations totally and absolutely free as a result of an appeal which I put in our parish magazine looking for an illustrator. And he's so kindly given his time and his skills and, you know, all that goes, the frustrations, everything that goes with getting a couple of books out in print. He's done that all so willingly. And if it weren't for him, there wouldn't be any books, because I could write them, but I can't illustrate. And then I couldn't really, don't have any money to pay anybody. It's all, everything is voluntary. The only people who are going to get paid or have already been paid are the printers. Everything I do is free, obviously, and everything Adrian does is free. So if, without his cooperation, I keep telling him we're a team, which is what we are. And so thank you, Adrian.
A lovely tribute there. And for the Laura Lynn Foundation, Ireland's only children's hospice, Mary, quickly, how can people buy this book?
Well, they can, I mean, I think Morgan will give you the address of the website. And I'm also leaving my own contact details with him. So if you are interested, I have loads, absolutely loads of the books at home. I live in off Griffith Avenue, which is not too far away from here. And I've given him permission to give my details to anybody. But I think if you go to him first, if you want to buy them directly from me. If not, go online, and it's quite easy. You just go on the Laura Lynn website, and I'm sure there's a link then to their online shop, and you can follow that and buy the books that way, and they will be delivered to you.
Mary, it's an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio today.
Well,
a wonderful book and a really, really wonderful cause.
Well, thank you very much, Morgan. It was a great opportunity to come in and meet you, and hopefully do a little plugging for the books. Christmas is coming, and the books would make very nice stocking fillers, I think. So I'm hoping now that there'll be plenty of sales after this, and I'm very, very pleased to have had the opportunity to come in and talk about it, about them and about books generally, and writing for children.
Mary, thanks very much. Just to give you that website again, very quick, folks, it's www.lauralynn.ie, and if you go onto the website, it's very easy to negotiate. You'll find the online shop, and the books are Piper's Pet Shop by Mary Shiel, illustrated by Adrian O'Reilly. Alternatively, you can email me. Of course, you can contact me at any time. The email is morgan_O'Reilly@live.com, or if you'd like to go on Twitter, it's morgan@morgan_O'Reilly. And of course, if you'd like to contact me that way, I can definitely put you in touch with Mary, or I do have a good few of the books in my own house if anybody would like to buy them. And it is a fantastic cause, folks. Laura Lynn, Ireland's only children's hospice. So please do get in touch and be a great little stocking filler, as Mary said, for Christmas. Anyway, coming up after the break, we have Paul Murray in studio to chat to us about his poetry. So stick around for that. Promises to be a great half an hour chat.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin built there over clay.
And you are very welcome back to Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. That was Stephen James Smith and Enda O'Reilly from the album Arise and Go, and you might have recognised some of the lyrics there. That was, of course, the Lake Isle of Innisfree, W.B. Yeats' very famous poem, put to music, as I said, by Stephen James Smith and Enda O'Reilly. Anyway, in studio now, we're blessed with the presence of Paul Murray, Dublin poet. Paul, how are you?
Hello there, how's it going?
Not too bad, how are you getting on?
I'm getting on well. I'm starting to relax now that you've given me my fee in advance. I like that. That's the type of place I want to be.
That fee shall remain unsaid for the rest of the program.
Okay, Morgan.
Just
I'm
in case.
Only joking, folks.
Any of the other writers are looking for money off me. But anyway, Paul, tell us about yourself. Could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Well, I'm originally from the what would you say, the west side of Dublin. Was born in Kimmage, in a housing estate, in Kimmage, very old-fashioned housing estate. And then my folks moved on to more salubrious parts of Drimna, up around the side of the canal, which if you read some of my poetry, you'll see there's a lot of canal poetry in it, because I could step outside my door and actually view across the fields to the canal. And I finally got married myself, and I moved to Ballyfermot, and which is also beside the canal. So I had that sort of upbringing. And I also found work mostly in the paper and printing and cartons and all that kind of cardboard and stuff. I worked in the Killeen paper mills in Ballyfermot. I worked in the Clondalkin paper mills. I also worked in a place in Kimmage, which was Alta and Wyburg, and they were a printing house. And I also worked in a place that made printing ink rollers. So I always had an, it wasn't a planned thing.
No.
It just happened when I was about 16, after a few various little types of messenger boy jobs, I decided that I needed to make more money. So you could make money in the paper mill by doing shift work or by overtime, and you could step up a little ladder of, it was general operatives type of work. There was no real big skills.
Yeah.
But that's basically the way I, when I left one job, I usually went for an interview in some other printing house. My aim at one time was to get into independent newspapers, which is dead and gone now. But because I knew people in it, and they said, this is the job for you, Paul. There's big money, and the job is easy. It's not like where you are. So I was to put all the cardboard box industry behind me and go into the big time.
Yeah. So that's two kind of constant themes in your life, was the body of water that was the Grand Canal, and the paper mill industry and
yes, that's
printing
true.
Industry.
Yes. So along the way, I when I was in my late teens and into my 20s, I started getting into music, as most young men do.
Of course.
And I joined a band. I became a trumpet player. And we'd done some little gigs around Dublin. And Morden's Hotel, I don't know what it's called now. It's on the corner of Gardner Street there. It's another name on it now. But we used to do a lot of regular gigs there and up in Mountjoy Square and just in the general vicinity of the city and anywhere and everywhere. But we weren't a terrific band. We mostly played dance music and a bit of maybe country music type of stuff, a bit of jazz. So in fairness, the greatest joy I got out of that, I used to write the songs for the band, which was very unusual in those times. We're talking about back in the 60s now, you know.
Mm.
So it wasn't something that a lot of people were doing. So I was never a great singer, because I have a kind of very baritone voice, so I can't sing terribly high. But I used to try and put them over, and then the singer with the band would do a couple of numbers.
Mm. And has music found its way into your poetry? So certainly reading your collection, there is.
It probably would. I'd say, for instance, I was mixed up in the Jane James's band, because my uncle was in there and he brought me down a couple of times, and my brother joined the band. So if you look at it, about my third poem and the third page, I'd say there's I'm trying to remember what I called the thing now.
There is a poem, St. James's Band.
Now, what number is that now?
That is page 13. Page
13. Okay. St. James's Band. So well, I'll just show you then. I used to sit in with them and listen to them and thought it was lovely. And I learned to play the trumpet there. But I wasn't really into marching bands. I wanted to be a little bit more cool in those times. And I wanted to attract the girls maybe a little bit better. So I thought, I could learn here and I could do the band. But of course, the people who ran the band wanted you marching out on Sunday and playing out in the local, you know, you could play in Hoth, you could play in Dunleary. You know, this is where James's band played at the time. So, but that poem there, it's just a memory of the time, just watching the band play.
Mm.
So I just call it St. James's Band. So I read this one for you.
Lovely.
Around the Sunday morning band room, sweep variations on rapture and riff. Above a semicircle of stacking chairs, a collective airing by brass and reed. Within this repository of music sheets, strict baton tempos for maestros apply. Reading the symbols, crafting the flow, an adagio here, some legato there. From a camaraderie of broody tuba, pour umpa tones on fangled flights, over stomping grounds for smooth trombones, to comfort zones of close harmony. With cymbals falling, or so it seemed,
for a soulful French horn's ad-lib charms. A snare drum clamoured to be heard above the trumpet's fanfared mockery. St. James's Band is a frame of mind, the stuff of sonics amid Mount Brownstone, a conservatory where notes are spun, and on Sunday morning, oh, how they shine.
Lovely. So that was me in St. James's Band Hall.
Lovely. St. James's Band there from Paul Murray's debut collection of poetry, Paper Trails. And there's a lovely line there at the end. St. James's Band is a frame of mind. And it kind of, to me, it's not just the music, it's not just the band, it's almost the poem and the poetry itself. Can I ask you, did you write from an early age?
Well, I did, but I wasn't writing poetry as such. You know, I did write rhymes. I remember writing rhymes at school, and, you know, just to entertain my peers, you know. And some of them, most of them were kind of funny, and they were, a lot of them I stole the tunes from old Irish ballads or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe it'd be a mocking poem about the school teacher, usually, or just the school bully or someone like that, you know.
Mm.
But I never really took up poetry as such, because I really hadn't got time. I had a very busy lifestyle, mostly enjoying myself. And I left school at 14, and I got a job in Grafton Street, in a shoe shop in Grafton Street. And it was a wonderful job. I was there for 2 years, and my job was to, when the van came with the shoes, to bring the shoes in and put them into the store downstairs. And at tea time later on, at 11s, shall I say, all the girls that would all get, it was a ladies' shoe shop, so all the girls would send me down to the shop for their cakes for their morning tea. And then in the lunchtime, then I would wander up to Stephen's Green and have a sit up there, and I usually got a free cream bun or something off the girls, you know. I tried to work me charm on them. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But Grafton Street, even back, now we're talking about the probably the 50s, the late 50s, but it was still a wonderful place. And all around the back of Grafton Street, where they have all these little cafes and all, it was still a wonderful place.
Yeah.
It was most to do with dressmaking and the clothes and the garment industry. It was more like that. But the alleyways and the places and coming out into George Street too, that where the market is now, that was always a market, but it seemed to be a market that was trying to make up its mind what kind of market it wanted to be. So I see now they've actually put it in a kind of an antique sort of thing,
yeah,
which is nice.
It's the Georgia Street Arcade.
Yeah, yeah, that's where. But I used to go because they had the Saxone Shoe Company was the name of the shop. And so they also had a shop in Georgia Street, and the man's shop was in Georgia Street. So I would go over there. They had other shops around the city as well. There was one on O'Connell Street.
Mm.
So it was kind of a little bit expensive. I mean, at the time I was there, I could never afford to buy a pair of shoes in it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So when I went on from that to, as I say, to various smaller jobs, and finally then I got a job in the paper mill up in Ballyfermot in Chicor, and I worked there for quite a few years, and then I went on to work in Clondalkin Paper Mill.
Mm.
So the one in Inchicore, there was another paper mill in Drimna, there was another one in Saggart, and quite a lot of people worked there now in the paper mill.
Quite a concentration out that neck of the
woods. Yeah, so it was great, because I think there was about 1,000 people working in the mill in the first, when I went up to the Killeen Paper Mill, the first one. If you look on the cover of the book, you'll see that's Killeen Paper Mill.
Indeed, yeah, it's a lovely old photo. And I was just looking on the kind of introductory page to the collection. There's a description, maybe, of your working life. And it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, or correct me if I'm wrong. It says, Paul spent his working life dancing to the tune of the paper and print industry. And it's a line that's repeated in one of the poems, Paper Mill Heartland.
That's right. Well, that's me at my work my first big job, I suppose. What number is that page?
Page 22.
22. Just as well you came along today, Rob.
Well, you're the talent. I just have to kind of poke you into...
Yeah, so this again is just telling my story, which I went to work on the bike, the push bike at those times. And it's just a little story about
my longings while I was going to work, my mind and my longings were for somewhere else. And of course the canal was always in my dreams somewhere along the way. So I'll just read this one for you. Paper Mill, Heartland. Over Ballyfermot's humpbacked bridge, the paper mill siren called my name. Come dance for me, the banshee wailed. Skip to the beat of a cardboard drum in my print and pack auditorium. Making elbow room twixt maidens and men, I blazed a trail down Killeen's River Road, setting my pace at pushbike speed along stony rights of passing tracks amid the rising pylons and smoking stacks. While a tarp-wrapped barge, morning pale, slipped the nearby lock gate's damp embrace to follow the reed-decked waterways, I punched my card and, when properly shod, danced to the tune of a make-paper god. Mid hissing steam, through grit and sweat, I served those hungry mouth machines with manual skills and diverse codes along the yellow brick road of the Union Man towards the mill workers in New Jerusalem. While baffles trashed and ground stuff down and man-sized cogs made demonic sound, I wondered where the canal barge might be. Perhaps, like a swan, she's paddling free where water and wings are the powers that be.
Lovely stuff.
So that was me longing to be on the barge, of course, you know, not wanting to be in the world.
And, well, it's definitely a nostalgic poem about the canal. I mean, you get that from the barge and the swans, and of course everybody who's familiar with Dublin will be familiar with the swans along the Grand and Royal Canal. But when you say the canal barge, I mean, you immediately think of the Guinness's barges, and especially for me, I mean, my family, great family history of working in Guinness's, and when you were talking there 5 minutes ago about walking up Grafton Street and walking out George's Street Arcade, there's definitely a sense of, you're memorialising a lot of Dublin in this collection of poetry.
Well, of course, you know, Dublin has changed a lot through the years. There's still a lot of good spots, and it's plenty of good Dublin stuff left, but a lot of it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, it will never come back now, because the demonics of the city have changed. And a lot for the better, I suppose. It has to be.
Of course.
We have to move along with Google and all these enterprises nowadays.
And the Silicon Docks. That's,
yeah, well, so what can we say? But there's a lot of stuff gone too. And so I try to capture stuff in my... I was in Smithfield there last year. This is a poem now for my new book coming up. And it's about walking in Smithfield in the night. I was in the Cobblestone Inn. Do you know the Cobblestone Inn in Smithfield?
Yeah.
They play a lot of music
yeah.
in there. Yeah, so I was
big
in there.
Big music pub.
And I came out, and it was, I think it was November or something like that. So this one is just called Smithfield Nightshade. Like space-age weaponry in a sci-fi movie, Smithfield's high-rise fog-guised street lamps, marooned on islands of January nightshade, sets an alien presence in an ancient square. Rising gothic-wise against midwinter scape, they stand ankle-deep in chill cobblestone, unbowed by the taxicab's freedom of flight across the ghost-glazed Liffey Glade shadowlands. All jingle bell jangle and horse whisper wheels, a tram shimmers past at benign river speeds. Windows shine, splashing bricked up stable yards, where once the fine art of blacksmith had thrived. A defrocked distillery's smokestack broods, recalling match factory maids in their prime, flirting with farm boys on Haymarket days against organic backdrops of livestock sales. A secluded stockade hunkers down amid trees, the last resting place for crushed traffic cones, lying in state amid the rusted street signs, bottom of the job pile in city fathers' agendas. So I just looking at the cityscape, I see it was January,
and thinking about those lampposts, that the one thing you notice in Smithfield, they're so enormous, they really take over the square. They seem to be like alien people coming at me. You know, this is what I thought anyway. So when I go somewhere, whether it's a night out or it's a day out, or nowadays I have free travel pass, so I could get on the train with my wife, I must say, to Killarney, and we head off, and maybe I'll come back with a poem. It's great to go and not know what it's going to be about. It may be about something entirely different than you think, but so it's again something you pick up along.
Lovely way to snapshot a certain place or a certain time or a certain event. Yeah.
So again, now when I got to my courting days, as we would say, when we got to walking with your girlfriend, I walked her along the canal bank. That's when I wooed her and captured her.
The canal is really central to every kind of different part of your life.
And I was never a great romantic poet of any kind, but things do come to your mind. So I read this one here. This is about me and her walking the canals. It's quite short. I call it True Believers. Beside a hogweed-scented canal, on damselfly drifting by days, I fished from towpaths of my prime, casting my lifeline further afield into depths of her gypsy shade eyes. While swan whites pillow slipped past, fine tangle islands lily pad weaned, fate sent us ripples of good intent through tasseled enchantments of reed, stirring love potions in wells of pinkine. Sturdy barges would carry our hopes along leaf-textured ribbons of shine to safe harbors for wading bird souls, where heaven opens its sluice gates a while, immersing true believers in joyful overflows. So, you know, so sometimes memory and romance and all that stuff comes flooding back, and you kind of remember.
You're talking about memory there, and you were talking about your free travel pass. You are, of course, retired. Do you feel retired in your poetry? Is age something that enhances your poetry?
I suppose, in fairness, I wrote poetry and song. I wrote a lot of songs in my lifetime, but it was only when I retired I really got into poetry. Because you see, you need time. You know, I needed time
to work on a poem.
Else. You need time to think about things and write them down, and rewrite them, and look at them in 6 weeks, and rewrite them again, and that's the way I write.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, so I don't think I could have wrote stuff when I was young, because poetry does take time. You need to be able to relax and sit by the side of a canal or a river, or in your back garden and contemplate on the birds pecking at your apples in the tree or something like this, you know. So, or look at your grandchildren and find out. I have one here again. This is for my next book, but it's about one of my grandchildren, my grandson. And when I pick him up from school, sometimes we go to the parks, and to the Phoenix Park. He loves the Phoenix Park because it's full of woods and
lovely,
there's
deer.
There's all squirrels and stuff. So this is called Togetherness. It's just me and him in the park. Within the Phoenix Park's tree-dappled realm, while deer herds grazed upon shoots of spring, Dara and me chose a place near the woods to build from windfalls of overnight storm a rough-boughed shelter for our two-man tribe. As we knuckled down to some open-air chores, an old fart and a young spark found common ground by toiling together like true blood brothers should, to wicker a hideaway from the all-prying eyes of those outsized park rangers on Jeep patrol. Far from video game lands and action man toys, upon a landscape of no school, homework or clocks, we pledged our allegiance to eco-warriors of yore, to stand by wild creatures and feathered friends against hunting dog trends among dog walking folk. While plump rabbits scampered down bird whistle trails and squirrels
leaped sprightly mid fallen leaf shades. We munched crusty bread sambos like woodmen would, with fizzy drink afters and soft jelly snake treats, showing life on the wild side can be glazed sugar sweet. As the Pope's cross warmed its steel shell in the sun, a lark choir sent blessings through anthems they sung for all those who labored in this tree-dappled realm to savor these heaven-sent leafy moments in time, for therein dwell the reasons for just being alive. Lovely. So that's me and the grandson, sort of. You know, we sort of have little...
The master and the apprentice.
Well, he's the master and I'm the apprentice, you know?
Of course, yeah. Paul, unfortunately, we're nearly drawn to a close here. Before I let you go, of course... We were reading a lot of poems from your collection, Paper Trails, but you've got another collection coming out.
Well, I'm hoped to have it coming out next year now, you know.
Hopefully next year.
It takes a lot of time to get it together.
Indeed.
You know, you have to have a few expertise from the publishing world. I don't know many well big publishers or anything like that, but I have good friends in the printing business because I was in it myself through the years, and they sort of are my critics. And I will give them a lot of stuff and they will sort it out and say, well, we like that, but we think you should get rid of that rubbish. You know?
we'll take one more poem from you, Paul. I'll sign off here. Thank you very much for coming in. But that's all we have time for today, folks. My thanks again to my guests, Mary Scheel and Paul Murray, for coming in. You've been listening to Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. If, as always, you'd like to contact the show, you can email me at morgan_O'Reilly@live.com. Or for all of the podcasts and information and events and stuff, go on Twitter. The Twitter handle is @morgan_O'Reilly. And we'll be tweeting all the info about Paul's poetry and about Mary Scheel's book for the Laura Lynn Children's Hospice Foundation after the show today. But I will leave you with a poem from our guest today, Paul Murray. Paul, it's all yours.
Well, I suppose one of my favourite actors is Clint Eastwood, because I love his movies. I know they're silly at times, but I just love them. And I love them watching them late at night. So this is me watching Clint Eastwood. I call this poem, Hurry. It's late night movie time on TV. I'm watching Dirty Harry again, cruising the San Francisco streets, keeping the bad guys in his sights, letting his peace do the talking. Make my day is his macho mantra. While I sip tea, he makes his move. Bang, bang. Two punks go down in a shower of liquor store glass. He's a walking combat zone, smashing low life beyond repair. Harry takes no prisoners. He gets his ass kicked sometimes, courtesy of his by-the-book captain, for pushing the pimps too hard along the sidewalks of Chinatown, where a dragon lady he once knew became chalk lines at a crime scene. Oh, to be a class act like Hardy, standing ice cool, taking no shit, sipping a neon-lit whiskey glass. Are you finished your tea yet? Asked the wife, eyeing my cup. Don't even think about it, said I.